newborn oxygenation and EMS provider treatment, where we stand on life expectancy, a study on giving blood products in the field, and we'll look at some of the key things we need to keep in mind when giving blood products to patients as our EMS tip of the week this week. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of The Medic Cast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is The Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis!
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's show. We've got some great stuff coming up for you in this week's episode, including some good news items. First off, in the news items this week, we'll be looking at how you are preparing for upcoming events like childbirth, and the way you prepare for them can help you avoid common errors when you deal with these types of events in the field. Then in the tip of the week this week, we'll look at how paramedics might need to administer blood products in some cases in the future, and some of the things they need to keep in mind about these specialized treatments in the field. That's all coming up later on in this week's tip of the week after the news. Before we jump into all of that, though, I do want to make sure that you are heading over and checking out the links and additional information that's available for you, all available for you over at the MedicCast blog. And you can find that over at MedicCast.com/blog. There's a show notes link right there at the top of the page. Click that link and it will take you right to the most recent episode. And you can scroll down there and find previous episodes as well. There's also a search box there in the upper right-hand corner of the page. So if you're looking for something in particular, just enter some keywords and search and see if we've covered it in a past episode. Make sure you take some time and follow up on the information you get in the show, though. Understand how what you hear me talk about applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, make sure you do so. You can email me directly at podmedic@mac.com. Just shoot me an email with any comments you might have, questions you have about the show. I've got a bunch of emails recently this week, so I've been responding back to them. So you can send me suggestions or interview ideas for future episodes or ask a question about an episode. But either way, I want you to know that I do respond back to every email that comes in, and I will get back to you as well. So keep those emails coming. Also, if you're an iPhone, Android phone, Windows phone, or Windows 8 user, make sure you check out the free MedicCast app for your device in the store. Just check MedicCast EMS app and search for that and you'll find it. And if you already have it, go back and leave a comment, rate the app, be an active supporter of the MedicCast community by supporting the spread of the MedicCast app to people you know. That's enough contact information. I'll go ahead and get on into this week's news, but please remember to support our sponsors and let them know you heard about them here on the MedicCast. Tell them thanks for supporting the show. Starting off this week's news, we're going to take a look at a study that looks at the causes of newborn asphyxia during and after birth. This study came out of Norway and looking primarily at the hospital setting, but I do think there are some lessons that we can learn here for EMTs and paramedics. So stay tuned for this coming up in this news item because there's a lot to be learned here. The study found that human error accounted for most situations of fetal and newborn asphyxia. Most often this was caused because of inadequate fetal monitoring, which we don't usually do in the field, but the other causes could be something we might deal with in the EMS sector. Along with the other causes related to human error were failure to follow clinical guidelines and medication errors. Now, these are certainly things we can relate to in EMS and something we can do something about for those times when we have infrequently dealing with childbirth in the field. The lesson here is to make sure you are familiar with your protocols and guidelines for childbirth and neonatal care. It's incumbent upon us as EMS providers to review our EMS education, especially on infrequently used skills and knowledge like neonatal care. Make sure you stay up to date on your training classes with things like PEP, pediatric education for pre-hospital providers, or even take pediatric advanced life support classes, PALS. According to the study, lack of oxygen to the infant or fetus led to the asphyxiation. We can often at least help with this by getting mom on oxygen right away during childbirth and provide access to blow-by oxygen to the newborn when needed after birth. You might never be what you would call comfortable with birthing a baby. I get that. You know, that's a lot to do in the back of your ambulance and you don't do it very often, but that doesn't mean you can't be prepared. So take the time, take a few minutes, once a month or so, to look over your guidelines and make sure you know what to do if and when that moment arrives. You could be a true lifesaver. Next up in the news is more bad news for the health and wellness of the average American. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, is an organization that promotes policies that will improve the economic and social well-being of people all around the world. It includes membership of about 34 countries, including the United States. The OECD recently released data on life expectancy of its member nations. Now, back in the 1970s, the U.S. had the highest life expectancy in the world. They had a lock on it. But that's no longer the case. Now, the U.S. ranks 26th out of 34 behind the country Slovenia. Slovenia, people! I can't think of a better way to say how far we've fallen with our failed healthcare system than to see us ranked so low on the list. I've talked in the past on the news about things that cause providers stress. Well, this causes me stress. Who are the top five leaders in the list of life expectancy in the world? Well, here they are. Switzerland, Japan, Italy, Spain, and Iceland. Our audience in Australia and New Zealand will be happy to know that they are in the top 10, too. But here in the U.S., we are way down at the bottom of the list. So what's the difference? Well, the U.S. life expectancy in the report is 80.1 years, while the top five all get an extra 2 years on average to deal with in their lives, Switzerland topping the list at 82.8 years of life expectancy. So the next time someone tries to tell you that we have the best, most successful healthcare system in the world with the best care, tell them to move to Slovenia and check them out. Now, this article comes at a point when we are no longer living the way we used to in the 70s, but that's because we're actually living longer than we did back then, about 8 years longer. But our increase in lifespan has not kept up with the lifespans of colleagues in the industrialized world. This report came out in a 213-page report, if you want to read the whole thing, and looks at the wellness of all the member companies. Countries, and it shows that the U.S. spends more on healthcare per person than any other country, but is getting way less for the investment. We apparently focus on high-tech medical treatments that don't pay off as much as simpler, more tried-and-true health interventions focused on elsewhere in the world. So the next time someone tells you we have it great here in the U.S. with our healthcare system, maybe we should all think about moving to Slovenia and checking out their healthcare system. Finally, in the news this week, we look at a study on trauma patients and blood product administration recently presented to the annual meeting of the American Heart Association in Dallas, Texas. The study looked at how pre-hospital transport might use tools like blood transfusion in the field for critical trauma patients. Now, the study had nearly 100 patients that received blood products like plasma or packed red blood cells during transport, either by ground or by air, to a trauma center. This was compared to nearly 500 standard trauma transports by EMS without blood product administration. The study's authors found that patients who received blood products in the field on the way to the trauma center were about 8% more likely to survive after 6 hours in the hospital. They also found that these patients were 13% more likely to survive to hospital discharge, but for some reason this was found not to be statistically significant. They do recommend more study on this, and they want to look at factors that might affect survival to discharge and further explain the significance of pre-hospital blood product administration. But I think this is something we do need to pay attention to, since we may have some form of blood products on some of our units, at least, in the near future. Certainly not all units, given current technology and access to blood products, but I think we can expect it on aeromedical units going out of major trauma centers on calls, or perhaps chase cars that can be sent from a local hospital directly with blood supplies from in-house. So look for more studies like this one in the future, and we'll continue to look at how we can refine our pre-hospital care for major trauma patients. This week on the Tip of the Week, I thought I'd follow up on that last news item on blood product administration for EMS providers and look at this type of specialized treatment. There are some important and special things we need to keep in mind when giving blood products, just like we do with any critical care medication or treatment. I recently had this covered in my paramedic research, and blood transfusion is one of the newer items that will be covered in the update for paramedics from National Registry, so you might be getting some more information on that as well. So let's take a look at what you need to keep in mind when giving or monitoring patients receiving blood products in this week's EMS Tip of the Week. So let's take a look at EMS blood product administration in this week's Tip of the Week. We're going to look at types of blood products that you might encounter. We'll also talk about a little bit about blood typing and specific precautions you need to keep in mind, especially surrounding blood typing and cross-matching. We'll talk a little bit about what you need to do specifically during the administration of a transfusion of blood products to a patient, and some of the assessments that you need to do on a regular basis with these patients to ensure that there's no adverse reaction going on, and talk a little bit about monitoring as well. So what are some of the types of blood products that we might see out there? Well, the first of all is just blood. Whole blood is one blood product that we're likely to encounter. But we might also see packed red blood cells. This is where a portion of the plasma has been removed and you're just getting red blood cells. And this can be particularly useful in, for instance, a trauma patient who has lost an amount of their blood. Remember, we replace fluids, but that fluid doesn't have any oxygen carrying capacity. So giving these patients packed red blood cells gives them the thing they need in their fluid, which is something to carry oxygen to the cells and reperfuse cells that are having problems with perfusion and shock. So that's packed red blood cells. We might also see platelets, and platelets are the primary initial clotting factor in the blood, the clotting agent in the blood. These are cell fragments, really, or decayed cells, or not decayed cells, but you know what I'm talking about. These aren't full cells anymore. They've been degenerated into these platelets. They're sticky cell fragments that, if the blood stops moving for any period of time, they start to clump together and begin the formation of a clot. So a patient with a clotting problem or the need to clot more efficiently can be given platelets themselves. This is not as likely to be seen in the EMS side of things. Plasma is another blood product, the actual fluid, the plasma itself from the blood. So if you have packed red blood cells and you remove the plasma from the blood cells, then you have that leftover plasma and you can give that. And of course, that's a better fluid to administer to a deficient volume depleted patient because while it doesn't have a packed red blood cells oxygen carrying capacity, it does have the colloidal characteristics of the blood fluid itself, because it is blood fluid. And so it's going to stay in the intravascular space and not leach out into the surrounding tissues. You might also see, and this is probably only in the hospital setting, albumin, gamma globulins for immune deficiency issues that patients might have. You might also see coagulation factors for patients with coagulation disorders. And you also might see other blood products. So be aware that there are other blood products out there, but we're really likely only to see whole blood, packed red blood cells, or even plasma in the field as something that would be transported primarily for trauma patients. So what do we need to keep an eye on here? Well, blood doesn't just exist in a vacuum. One person's blood does not automatically transfer easily to another person. They need to have some similar things going on. First of all, we look at the proteins that are present on the surface of the cells, and this is what blood typing and cross-matching looks at primarily. It's these proteins that someone can have an immune reaction to if they are identified as not being from the patient. So we need to give someone blood that is very similar in the protein mixture on the outside of the cells, that the blood cells that the patient has themselves. And this is what we do when we do blood typing and cross matching. So the primary blood typing that is done out there is ABO, group typing, which you probably have heard of. You probably even know your own blood type. This is something that used to be done commonly in high schools, although they don't do it so much anymore for fear of bloodborne pathogens. But when I was in high school, we actually found out our blood type using a simple test kit to put a spot of blood on, and it would determine what our blood type was. I'm O negative, but you could be A, you could be B, you could be AB, or you could be O. A is the presence of A proteins, B is the presence of B proteins, but no A proteins, and AB is the presence of both A and B proteins. O patients are patients without either of the A or B primary proteins on the outside of their cells, which means that these patients can be universal donors for many patients. Now, there's also the Rh factor, and this is either positive or negative. It's another protein factor that's found on the blood cells. And you're either positive for it or you're negative for it. So O negative has neither A nor B proteins and has no Rh factor. So this is the perfect universal donor. If you had to quickly find blood for a trauma patient and you didn't have time to type them and find a specific perfect cross match, you could use O negative blood as the universal donor. The universal recipient would be AB positive. AB positive means they have both A and B proteins, and they're positive for Rh factor, and these patients can receive blood products from anyone. So there's the universal donors and the universal receivers for blood products. Now, there's also cross-matching, and we're not going to go a whole lot into that, but this actually will go beyond the ABO group typing and Rh factor typing and actually looks at some of the other clotting factors and things like that in the blood. And what they basically do in the lab is they mix two small droplets of blood, from one from the patient and one from the donor, together, and then they observe them to see if there's any unusual clumping. And if this clumping or a clotting occurs, then it's not good to give this blood to that patient. So they do ABO typing and Rh factor typing first. They know what that is for the blood. And then as a last cross match, they take that blood and they test it to see if it's a good match for the patient. And if it's not, they try someone else's donated blood. So that's a good thing to keep in mind. Now, there's also an ISBT barcode that's on all blood products administered throughout hospitals in the industrialized world, at least. This is the International Society of Blood Transfusions came up with a barcode system that actually is trackable for all blood products. So we can it comes with a bunch of stickers that comes with the packet of blood, and we put a sticker on the chart, and we put a sticker on the patient, and we put a sticker on the IV stand, and we put a sticker everywhere to say this blood product was given to this patient. And we use this to also verify that the correct blood product was given to the correct patient. So we match up. You know, you get a busy ER or trauma center, you could have multiple patients receiving blood products. By having this barcoding system, it prevents accidentally giving the wrong blood to the wrong patient. Transfusion precautions, things to keep in mind as we start considering transfusing blood products. We want a careful history, if possible, for the patient. If we can find out definitively what that patient's blood type is, that would be very helpful. We need to know if they've had any past transfusion reactions. Now, obviously, in a severe trauma patient, you may not be able to find out all this information, but in a perfect world, you'd be able to ask a family member or the patient themselves, have you ever been transfused for blood before? Have you ever had a bad reaction to blood transfusions before? The more transfusions someone has, the more sensitized they become to getting someone else's blood. So each time they get a subsequent transfusion of blood on a different occasion, that person can be more sensitive to the cross match deficiencies than they were otherwise. So we need to look at that. So have they had these past transfusion reaction? Remember to use your ISBT barcode, your stickers. You need to have one for your chart. There's like dozens of them on each packet. So there's plenty of barcode stickers to go around, but you need to be making sure, double checking the numbers on the barcode to match up to what was supposed to go to the patient, what you actually have hanging for the patient. Is it the same? And does it match the barcode you have for your chart? So all these things have to go together. Compare all the blood products and everything. You may get a second set of blood, a second unit of blood to hang during transport in addition to the one that's already hanging for the patient. And if you're allowed to give that blood product and spike it and hang it in, when the one is done, you need to go through the same process with that packet of blood. Does the barcode from that blood match the barcode that was matched and typed and cross-matched for this patient? And there'll be a separate form that's signed in triplicate that a nurse will verify with you. You need to double check it with them, sign off on it that, yes, I'm getting these two packets of blood. One's hanging, one is being given to me, and the barcodes for both match with the barcodes on the slip from the blood transfusion lab. And the blood donor bank or wherever it's coming from. So be aware that that's what you need to keep an eye on. When it comes time to actually give the blood products to the patient, you need to keep in mind that you are going to recheck compatibility. Now, I know this sounds crazy, and I'm harping on this, but I can tell you from my nursing background that you don't want to have a patient have a negative reaction to blood products, especially if you give them the wrong blood by accident. So double, triple, quadruple check that barcode. So you're going to check it when you get it. You're going to check it when you hang it, and you're going to check it before you hit the button to start administering it to the patient. All of this is going to be carefully done. You're going to ensure IV line patency. We'd like a large bore IV on this one, but it doesn't have to be an 18 gauge. I've, you know, been there when they've given blood products to patients through a 22 gauge. It takes a little bit longer and it's a little bit slower, but it can be done. Everybody thinks blood's so thick that you can't squirt it through there, but it does just fine. Obviously, we will probably start large bore IVs for trauma patients if possible, but don't freak out if you have a child, for instance, or an elderly person where all you could get on them was a 22 gauge in the hand or something. You can still administer blood products through that line. You're going to probably use an infusion pump for this. It's important to do so you can monitor how fast the blood is going in and do it slowly. You'll want to start slowly at first, maybe 5 mLs per minute. And then after about 15 minutes and you've been continuously monitoring the patient and you've seen no reaction, then you can go ahead and give it at whatever your standard rate would be. But you want to monitor these patients carefully during this time frame. And then after you ramp up the speed, you're going to continue to monitor them frequently. Some of the things you need to keep track of and look for is an acute hemolytic reaction. This is a reaction to blood products, and it'll be basically an immune system response, an allergic reaction. Some of the things you might see include signs of fever, sudden onset of chills. They might have the beginnings of respiratory distress or shortness of breath. They might complain of lower back pain, and this is because of pain that's experienced in the abdominal organs as they react to the blood products. They also might complain of nausea, vomiting. They might complain of itching. Look for the presence of hives, swelling, just like any normal allergic reaction, because that's what it is. And pain at the infusion site. So if you have redness and streaking up the arm, that's a sign that they're having a reaction to that blood product. And what do you do? Real simple. You stop it. Okay. Yeah, they might need the transfusion because of the trauma situation, but we don't want to give them a systemic allergic reaction and have them go into anaphylactic shock on top of their hypovolemic shock. So we don't want to contribute to that and break down any of their compensatory mechanisms that might be dealing with a hypovolemic shock situation. So discontinue as soon as you see any of these signs or symptoms. So what do we need to keep track of? Well, this is something you're going to do with your own system. And I want you to be aware that this is not something that's going to be a usual standard part of your EMS protocols. However, if you're a critical care transport unit, if you're a flight medic, you might be somebody who has to deal with hanging blood products or starting blood products in the field. And you should be aware of some of these things, some of what to expect when getting handling blood transfusions for your patients. I have a lot of references that I found on this. There's some good information that's regularly updated over at the Merck Manual for Professionals site. And there's a link in the show notes to this. It's on blood products and transfusion medicine. I also found a French study on out-of-hospital blood transfusion by emergency medical services that you might want to look at. And an article over at emsbasics.com on understanding shock and blood transfusion. So take a look at those references and utilize them when you get a chance. And of course, I would also, I don't always use Wikipedia, but in this case, Wikipedia has some great information on blood typing, cross-matching, and the ISBT system. So if you want some more information and want to go deeper on that, I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and remind you to follow up on all of the information from this week's show. You'll find it over at mediccast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a link in the show notes for the top of the at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on the information and the links to news items and other things you'll find there each week. You can also sign up for the email newsletter. That's right there on the right-hand side of the page. Put in your name and email address, and it'll bring those links directly to your email inbox each week. So just fill that out and get that right to you and get the MedicCast weekly newsletter. I also welcome your comments and your suggestions by email directly, so shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com and send in your ideas for future episodes, like today's topic of traumatic asphyxiation. Send in your interview segments or whatever comments you have. I look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media sites or social media pages, well, you can find me most places under the handle PodMedic. So go ahead and catch me over on Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or over on Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic. Make sure you friend or follow me over there so we can catch up online. And don't forget to check out the MedicCast Facebook page. We have almost 5,000 followers right now. So head over and check out the page over at facebook.com/mediccast. Click the like button at the top of the page and join our community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with people you know, your colleagues, your students, if you're an EMS instructor, friends in the EMS world, and let them know about the show. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, interviews, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. So tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, most importantly, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.